This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It is a very forgotten crisis, although it's one of the most catastrophic ones, not just in terms of displacement, but in terms of hunger, lack of access, violation of human rights.
That's United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi on Sudan's conflict leading forced global displacement to historic heights. Details coming up also. South Africa's parliament is expected to re-elect Cyril Ramaphosa as president tomorrow. And the Russian foreign minister's visit to Africa included strong anti-Western sentiments. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We go with our top story. South Africa's new unity government is beginning to take shape with members of parliament set to re-elect African National Congress leader Cyril Ramaphosa as president tomorrow. The ANC dropped to 40% of the vote in a recent election and needs support from opposition parties to form a government. Darren Taylor reports.
The conservative Zulu nationalist Inkatha Freedom Party, the IFP, yesterday became the first party to confirm it'll join with the ANC in a government of national unity. The IFP also said South Africa's second biggest party, the Democratic Alliance, the DA, will be part of the deal. Local and international economists and political experts consider the DA's inclusion to be crucial in maintaining stability and ensuring growth going forward. The DA's business-friendly plans to end South Africa's electricity, water, unemployment and crime crises have been praised, even from some inside the ANC. Importantly, say some analysts, the DA has agreed not to push for an end to the ANC's black economic empowerment and affirmative action policies. One of the DA's lead negotiators, Tony Leon, says the party is moving toward a governance agreement with the ANC.
I think things are at a rather delicate diplomatic stage. I'm not going to speculate, and I really have no idea who the other parties are who might or might not come into this. That's not part of where I'm at. The DA has been very constructive in this process. We've been very engaged in our discussions with the ANC and with the IFP, and there are going to be further consultations today. And hopefully we'll come to a conclusion before 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I can also say, because I've been in this radio before, that often when you get to the final hours, that's where the most difficult matters get to be resolved. And we are getting to the final hours, and hopefully we will reach a resolution.
Leon's comments and the IFP's announcement that the DA will be in government are the clearest signs yet that major opposition parties Umkhonto weSizwe, MK, and the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, will not be in the coalition. Both have leftist policies, including state control of all forms of wealth, such as mines, banks, and land, to be distributed among the poor. At a news conference in Johannesburg yesterday, EFF Deputy Leader Floyd Shivambu said the ANC is frightened of his party because it wants to end white and black elitism.
There seem to be some puppet master who is in control of the national leadership of the ANC, who's telling them what to do. So that seems to be defining a certain section or faction in the ANC to characterize the EFF as enemy number one, which must never be entertained on any issues that involve government. Clearly, the ANC is going to work with the Democratic Alliance. Anti-racism, anti-imperialism, those are the values that we have given to the ANC, but they don't want to talk about that. They just want to elite pack. The white capitalist establishment is controlling the ANC to tell them what to do.
Together, MK and the EFF won almost a quarter of votes. Yet, at this stage, it appears neither will have a say in governance. Constitutional expert Pierre Defosse says there's little legally MK and the EFF can do about this because they don't have the numbers in Parliament. Yesterday, MK lost a court application asking for the opening of Parliament to be delayed. MK alleges the election was rigged, but has not presented evidence to back the allegation. Some political analysts say millions of MK and EFF supporters won't be happy at the exclusion of their parties, and there's potential for violence. Some of South Africa's top security officials tell VOA forces have been sent to strategic areas and special response units on standby to prevent potential unrest. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Reporter Tuso Kumalo spoke with people in Johannesburg to get their thoughts on what they hope to see from a new government. Jermaine Lewis is not optimistic that things will improve.
You know what? All of that part is corruption. That's why I don't vote, because of this corruption. There's no job where I'm going to get money. But the hospital is corruption. But the parties is corruption. Tell you sitting in church is corruption. So I don't know what to say.
Lukawa Bradford also is frustrated with the political situation in the country.
It's a banana republic. Can you have 42 parties voting and yet coalition governments, this one is fighting because this one wants to be seen. You know what we call these political leaders? Glorified liars. Let them come and fix. Let them come and clean up the dams here. Let them give us proper housing.
Go to voaafrica.com or voanews.com to stay on top of the latest developments in the ANC's effort to build a coalition government after its historically low poll numbers. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports global forced displacement surged to historic heights last year, driven by conflict, persecution, human rights violations, climate crisis, and other disturbing events. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UNHCR reports 117.3 million people were forcibly displaced worldwide by the end of 2023. More than half, 68.3 million people, were uprooted from their homes by conflict and are displaced inside their own countries. At least 31.6 million more people have fled for safety across borders as refugees. The report finds the number of forcibly displaced continued to rise this year and now stands at more than 120 million. It says a key factor driving these surging numbers is the conflict in Sudan. At the end of last year, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says conflict had uprooted a total of 10.8 million people in Sudan from their homes. He says now the number of internally displaced alone has risen to nearly 10 million, and 2 million have sought refuge abroad.
I can speak more about Sudan. I am very keen to single it out first because I think it is a crisis that generally doesn't really make it to the headline. It's a very forgotten crisis, although it's one of the most catastrophic ones, not just in terms of displacement, but in terms of hunger, lack of access, violation of human rights, and so forth.
Other crises that have created a spike in new forced displacements are the conflicts in Myanmar and Gaza. And then there are what the report calls the endless conflicts that continue to displace people. They include Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Somalia. Repressive governments and economic crises are forcing some to flee their homes in Venezuela and Nicaragua as well. Grandi says population movements are complex and a result of diverse factors. For example, he says conflict is often sparked by the impact of climate change on people's livelihoods.
It can be a driver of conflict and hence of displacement, especially when, you know, the very scarce resources of poor communities become even scarcer than because of climate change, that drives conflict. We've seen it in so many parts in Africa, in the Sahel, for example, in the Horn of Africa, but also elsewhere.
The report debunks a common perception that all refugees go to rich countries. The UNHCR says most refugees are hosted in countries neighboring their own. It says 75% live in low and middle-income countries that together produce less than 20% of the world's income. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenya's finance minister is due to present today the country's biggest ever budget alongside a controversial finance bill that contains a number of new or increased taxes. President William Ruto's government has drawn up a 4 trillion shilling or $31 billion budget for 2024-25. The French news agency AFP says that's up from 3.75 trillion shillings for the current fiscal year. Parliament has already approved the proposed budget, but the separate finance bill aims to fill the coffers of the cash-strapped government. It proposes a host of tax hikes expected to hit the financial services, manufacturing, and retail sectors. One of the most contentious provisions is the introduction of a 2.5% motor vehicle tax and the reintroduction of a value-added tax on bread. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov did a tour of African nations last week that was marked by strong anti-Western sentiment and the promise of greater military backing against extremist militants. Chad is one of the last countries Moscow is trying to ally with in the Sahel region, with not long ago France's sphere of influence. In Chad, he held talks with General Mahamat Idriss Deby, who has just been elected president after 3 years at the head of a military junta. David Monda, professor of political science at City University in New York, discussed this Russian tour with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Russia is continuing to extend its influence in the continent. And by his visit to Chad, he was previously in Guinea, in Burkina Faso, and also in the Congo. We see Russia making a geostrategic move by trying to connect all these countries in the Sahel, where we've had previous French and American influence. But these countries have been rejected mostly by the Western countries for military coup d'etat. So you see Russia also expanding its influence in that regard. I think in terms of President Deby's regime, the second level to this is also diplomatic, because we know the Chadian election was heavily contested. So when the Russian foreign minister pays a visit to N'Djamena, it legitimizes the rule of, you know, President Deby. And then the other element of this is that Russia is also very keen to expand its security and economic and trade relations with the region. So here we know Russia is far behind the European Union and the Americans in terms of weapon sales and in terms of trade. So Russia is looking to expand that with Chad. But Russia is also very eager to become a major arms supplier for Chad and for the region, in addition to providing intelligence and also to providing troops and mercenaries, for example, through the Wagner Group. So there's a whole range of items here, both in terms of the political, economic, diplomatic, security, and also soft diplomacy, the cultural diplomacy that's at play with Lavrov's visit.
Do you see Chad joining many African countries welcoming Russia's boosting its influence in Africa and replacing Western powers?
Very much so. And Chad and the countries in the Sahel are making a strategic play here. So they want to expand their diplomatic portfolio. In other words, they want to show that Washington and Paris are not the only games in town, that Chad, these countries in the Sahel, if they're rejected by Western powers, they always have China and Russia that they can turn to. I think the other element of this visit is that many African countries have failed, particularly in the Francophone Africa, that France and the West have tended to talk past them, right, to belittle them and not always to be listening to their voices. And they feel that countries like Russia, because they don't have the colonial baggage, that they tend to be more inclined to want to listen to what the specific needs of the African countries are. And I think this is one of the other reasons why you'll see Russia becoming really popular within the Sahel and in particular in Chad.
Lavrov has offered to strengthen economic, trade, and above all, military cooperation with Guinea, Congo, and Burkina Faso, his first African stops. And he said, "I have no doubt that thanks to this cooperation, the pockets of terrorists which remain in Burkina Faso will be destroyed." Could Russia replace the US and France in counter-terrorism efforts in the Sahel?
I think that's very much the case, because of the recent departure of U.S. troops from both Chad and also from Niger. Because I think there's been a feeling in N'Djamena that the U.S. troops have not been doing enough against the jihadists. So once the U.S. troops have left Chad, we see Russia as a natural force that can be able to fill that power vacuum, particularly in regards to the fact that Russia is very skilled in dealing with these jihadi movements. Russia's had its own radical Islamist issues in areas like Chechnya, Dagestan. Russia's been very active with ISIS in Syria, its ally in the Middle East. So I think countries like Chad feel that Russia is a natural ally, and not only because they have the military capability, but they also have the intelligence capability to deal with some of these jihadi groups.
That was David Mander, professor of political science at City University in New York, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. In this U.S. presidential campaign, guns continue to divide Americans. President Joe Biden wants a ban on assault weapons. His opponent, Donald Trump, says Biden is threatening the constitutional rights of gun owners. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports the president spoke about guns on a day when his son was convicted of lying about his drug use to illegally buy a gun.
President Joe Biden told gun control activists in Washington Tuesday that he needs their help to strengthen gun laws.
We need you to overcome the unrelenting opposition of the gun lobby, gun manufacturers, so many politicians, when they oppose common sense gun legislation.
Biden called for a federal ban on assault weapons and criticized Republican opponents for trying to close the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, which is responsible for fighting gun crime.
You can't be pro-law enforcement and say you are pro-law enforcement and be pro-abolishing the AFT. You can't do it. It's outrageous.
Nearly a third of Americans say they have a gun, according to the Pew Research Center. Donald Trump told America's largest gun lobby in May that Biden wants to take away those guns.
If the Biden regime gets four more years, they are coming for your guns, 100% certain.
Trump says gun rights in the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment would be guaranteed by his election, but threatened by Biden's election.
If they get in, our country is going to be destroyed in so many ways, but the Second Amendment will be, it's under siege. But with me, they never get anywhere.
Trump told the National Rifle Association that gun owners will make him a winner in November.
These are great patriots. These are great people. And we're going to do things like nobody can believe. We're going to win this election at levels that nobody's ever seen before.
Trump's record on gun control as president is reason not to reelect him, Biden says.
My predecessor told the NRA convention recently. He's proud that, quote, "I did nothing on guns when I was president." And by doing nothing, he made the situation considerably worse.
Biden spoke about guns Tuesday on the same day his son Hunter was convicted on charges including illegally purchasing a gun. Joe Biden did not speak about his son's convictions, but did issue a written statement saying he'll accept the outcome of this case and continue to respect the judicial process. Hunter Biden is the first child of a sitting U.S. president to be convicted of a crime and is scheduled to stand trial on separate federal tax fraud charges in September. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Some Southern African countries pushing against the United Kingdom's anti-hunting efforts suffered a blow when the Labour Party, expected to form the next government, committed to support a ban on hunting trophy imports. Six African countries, however, want the party to at least consult with them on the policy. Mokandisi Dube reports from Habrone.
Angola, Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, Zambia and Zimbabwe say in a joint statement they are disappointed Britain's Labour Party will attempt to ban hunting trophies. The countries say, however, that unlike the Conservative government, the Labour Party has at least pledged a full consultation on a policy with significant ramifications for conservation programs in our countries. Botswana, with the largest elephant herd in the world at more than 130,000, has been at the forefront of a campaign against the UK and other European nations' efforts to ban hunting trophies from Africa. Countries like Botswana and Zimbabwe are actively pursuing alternative markets in light of Europe's manoeuvres. Boatametse Mutukanele is Botswana's permanent secretary in the Ministry of Environment and Tourism.
We are already engaging with other markets. We are looking at the Middle East. We are also looking at United Arab Emirates as an example. We are looking at those countries because they also have a hunting culture and they don't have the many restrictions that we have currently.
UK-based Adam Hart, an ecologist and conservation scientist specializing in Southern Africa, tells VOA he's disappointed with the Labour Party's move.
It shows perhaps that they haven't listened to the science that's gone in front of the Conservative Party and they haven't listened to the voices of the affected nations. But it's not a big surprise that they've put it in now. I think politicians see this as quite an easy win, and it's only when they start getting more involved with the issue that they realise that it's nowhere near as straightforward as they thought.
In its manifesto, the Labour Party says it will put forward a comprehensive plan to end animal cruelty that includes a ban on the import of hunting trophies from abroad. Hart, a professor at the University of Gloucestershire, says the Labour Party must be honest in its consultation with the affected Southern African countries.
We have to give them the benefit of the doubt and suggest that perhaps the consultation will be genuine. Many people, when they go into this debate, think that they have the answers. They think that it's a very straightforward and simple issue, that banning hunting trophies will save endangered species. Of course, once you start digging into the issue, you realise it's much more complicated than that, and that, in fact, it could have the exact opposite effect. So hopefully they will take this consultation seriously.
In April, envoys from the six Southern African countries wrote to Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy expressing hope the Labour Party will consult on the hunting policy now contained in the party's manifesto. Kondisi Dube, VOA News, Habrone, Botswana.
Unidentified assailants in Niger killed six soldiers guarding a major Niger-Benin oil pipeline yesterday. One source told Reuters the pipeline was not damaged. No one has yet claimed responsibility for the first attack on security forces protecting the pipeline. Jihadist groups like the Al-Qaeda and Islamic State operate in the area. The nearly 2,000-kilometer pipeline is backed by PetroChina. It was officially opened in November, linking Niger Agdem oil field to Benin's coast, where the crude oil is loaded for export. And a new report has, for the first time, found traces of highly potent opioids known as nitazenes in drugs consumed in Africa's retail drug market. According to the Associated Press, the report was released yesterday by the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime nonprofit. The study tested Kush, a derivative of cannabis mixed with synthetic drugs and chemicals in Sierra Leone and Guinea-Bissau. The World Health Organization says many young people in West and Central Africa are using illegal drugs, with between 5% and 13% of them using cannabis, the most widely used illicit substance on the continent. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Kayla Williams, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.